You fellas want to read me my rights?
You have the right to have your face kicked in by me. You have the right to have your balls stomped by him.
I'll waive my rights.
They're pretty simple. The forms are all standard, boilerplate.
Okay, well, we're all hungry. We're gonna get to our hot plate soon enough, all right? But let's talk about the contract here.
Sorry.
You'd be surprised how many doors a letter from a lawyer can open or close.
It seems like you're talking slower since you started charging by the hour.
What's the meaning of this? This is my quiet time.
We're gonna have to take you into custody.
That's outrageous. What am I charged with?
Don't have to tell you anymore. Clearly haven't been reading your Scalia.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 178. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your lawyerly host, your belt and suspenders lawyer host, Andrew Torres.
Hey, Thomas, how are you doing?
I am doing great. You know, due to a scheduling thing, I had to have Brian. I got to give Brian credit for the opening quotes this week. However, it was the 20th anniversary of us losing Phil Hartman, and there was no Lionel Hutz, so I had to fire Brian. So Brian has been left out. But I still want to thank him for the work. But I'm sorry, that's an unacceptable outcome. So how are you doing?
I am doing well. I just finished replying, I think, to the 11,000th person who said there were problems with my audio last week.
Yes,
I know.
Yes.
I hear you. I promise we've got it fixed. But thank you for bringing it to our attention. Thanks for listening carefully.
I think we've got it fixed enough. I think that Mac people unite. Andrew needs to get a Mac. Everybody chant it. Start emailing. Andrew needs to get a Mac. Andrew. So that'll be further how we solve it. But we've got so much to talk about today. I'm excited to be with you guys. So we are going to talk about John Edwards, something I've brought up because I've heard it referenced in regards to the election laws and stuff like that, and how that compares with Donald Trump and his case now. And then there's more on the NFL. We've got some good listener questions, I think, about what specifically might change your mind on the NFL question of whether or not it has the right to do what it has done with the anthem, stuff like that. And then finally, we've got maybe Andrew was wrong. We'll see. Andrew was kind of wrong. I don't know. In the C segment. I'll just leave it at that. I'll leave that as a cliffhanger. We'll see.
Yeah, you got to listen to the whole episode, people.
That's right. So what are we not talking about today? Because I see excessive notes on what we're not talking about.
Yeah, so a whole bunch of things, right? Number one, I have gotten just tremendous feedback from patrons, from listeners on plea bargaining. And so we're going to do that next week. We are also going to do two developments in abortion law, the Trump global and domestic gag order, and also a recent development at the Supreme Court. So we're going to do abortion and plea bargaining next week, deep dives. Make sure you tune in on Tuesday. And then there are a couple of topics that I don't see that we're going to cover really at all, but I want to make sure if our listeners are looking for guidance, they know, you know, where we've covered these or what our thoughts are. So literally about an hour ago, the Trump administration announced that it was going to allow tariffs on imported steel from the EU, Canada, and Mexico to kick in on Friday by the time this show drops. We covered tariffs on OA 162. That this is obviously slightly different than the China tariffs, but same principles apply. So if you're curious, our take on the tariffs, we give both the legal.
Yeah, same principle of it's super easy to win a trade war. It's the step three, step four, profit, I think is that it's that.
Yeah.
Step one, I might skip one. Step one, start a trade war. Step two, step three, profit. I think that's how it goes.
Right. And stealing underpants is definitely in there somewhere. So. So yeah, go to OA162 on tariffs. We got a bunch of questions on Roseanne, and I'm not really sure why, right? Like, I mean, that's our libertarian paradise, right? Like, that's the market has spoken. We do not want Ambien riddled racists on television. And the hypocrisy is just kind of crazy to me.
But we've got to be careful to not fall into the trap, you know, because I think one tiny sliver of good news of bright sunshine to all this mess is the fact that this NFL thing and the Roseanne thing happened so close together. I think people are realizing they need to argue not on whether or not companies have the right to do this, but on what it is right to do. You know what I mean? Like, so because it happened so close together, I've seen some self-conscious people be like, self-aware people be like, oh, I guess I can't just say that they don't have the right to do that. So, cause I just said that a second ago. So, so it's like, I think we need to be having a debate about what is acceptable discourse, not whether or not companies have the right to do this. And in my opinion, kneeling during the anthem is completely acceptable. So that's my take.
But, awesome segue to our main segment, because I want to pick that issue back up at the end of our B segment. So you've now teased the end of the show and foreshadowed the B segment. Can't ask.
I'll just have to find a way to tease the A segment.
Yeah.
Now.
All right. And then the last thing we're not covering that just came down the pike is Donald Trump's pardon of Dinesh D'Souza. The reason for that, we may tackle it. I want to talk to friend of the show and election law expert Beth Kingsley and find out my recollection. And again, not my area, not an expert. It broke about 10 minutes ago. So take this with, you know, a pound of salt. My recollection is it's pretty rare to be convicted under the campaign finance laws because what D'Souza did by directing his employees' funds to political candidates is something he could have gotten around, but he was just really, really stupid about it. And again, that's my recollection. So the idea that, you know, it's a political witch hunt or whatever, I mean, it just seems crazy, obviously. It illustrates, you know, the kind of, we've got an Overton window that's attached to, you know, a 747 and is rocketing to the right as quickly as possible, that, you know, this is very, very clearly, we've now reached the point where the right wing is happy when you do nice things for its heroes, regardless of whether they've committed crimes or not. And if that's what the game of politics is, then I want to take my ball and go home, right? Like, I do not want to be cheering when, you know, I'm trying, like, when Bill Clinton pardons, yeah, like Mark Rich, you know,
President Kanye pardons, like, Weinstein or something,
right?
It's like, no,
dear God,
sorry.
Yeah, I mean,
won't happen. You know, that really is, I mean, it's not literally equivalent, but like, it's approaching. I mean, the Arpaio pardon, yep. I mean, it approaches that level of just awfulness, and they cheered that. So much of an exaggeration was that?
I don't know how much of an exaggeration it is. I mean, what I will say is, as Bill Clinton was leaving office, he pardoned Mark Rich and a bunch of campaign financiers. Right? I mean, he sort of had the shame to do it on his last day because Democrats were like, no. You know, this is not right. Like, if somebody illegally raises campaign funds for a president, a candidate, a political party I like that's still a crime. And I'm not a huge fan
of Bill Clinton. And I also realized I used President Kanye before he went on his protest. If President Anthony Weiner pardons Weinstein, I'm not going to be cheering just because it triggers the conservatives or something. That's not how we're doing things.
So. Yep. Agreed.
All right. Now we can finally get to the show.
Yeah.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
So, Andrew, let's talk about John Edwards. So, patron Thaddeus asks, and I want to point out, this was an extra Q&A question. We obviously can't get to all of them, and this was a really good one. So we wanted to tackle it on the show, and we also wanted to use it as an opportunity to show you what the Q&A is all about, which is patrons get to ask us questions. Not by us, I mean mostly Andrew. And Andrew answers
no,
them.
No, you answered a bunch. There were
Some, yeah. If they direct them toward me, I'll answer some. And we do it on video. It's lots of fun. And as I alluded to last time, we're now allowing everybody to come watch the video. So thank you to everybody who joined us. That was just yesterday for us. That was just Wednesday. And we'll make sure this month that we announce it again with plenty of time. So it's lots of fun. Make sure you do. It's a good patron benefit to be able to ask these questions. And with that in mind, patron Thaddeus asks, in 2011, John Edwards was indicted on several counts related to using campaign funds to cover up an affair. FEC also involved as well. In the end, he was found not guilty for illegal use of campaign funds. How does this relate to Trump and Stormy?
Yeah, I really love this question. I have seen it in a couple of areas where, you know, I mean, the only folks really left defending Donald Trump are kind of walking two quoque fallacies. You know, they're starting to bubble up, right? We've already tackled why Stormy Daniels is not like Monica Lewinsky. And now there's a, yeah, but this is just like John Edwards. And it is such a preposterously stupid argument that I think it's worth us tackling. First, let's begin with the ways in which it's like Trump and Stormy Daniels, right? Which is to say John Edwards was having an affair with Riel Hunter that began in 2007 while he was running for president, which displays a rather astonishing lack of judgment, if nothing else. I have to admit, I don't know where you were politically in 2007, Thomas.
We don't want to talk about that.
Yeah, this was in your conservative days.
Well, this was probably in my jaded, what is it all? What does it matter? Conservatives, liberals are all the same. Who cares? That's where I was.
I am picturing emo Thomas with washed out emo. Black hair and listening to The Cure going, oh, what does any of this even matter anymore? Oh, that would be fantastic.
Not exactly, but I'll let you have that.
Yeah,
I'll let you have
that image. Give me my fantasy, Thomas. It's all I have left. So, yeah, no, my political views were kind of roughly the same now that they were 10 years ago. And in 2007, I was a John Edwards supporter. And the big reasons that I was a John Edwards supporter were kind of twofold. Number one, I was really, really impressed with the degree of candor and the lessons that he felt like he learned out of being the vice presidential candidate in 2004. He came out and said, look, the reason I think we lost in 2004 is because I voted for the Iraq war. And I thought that was a massive mistake on my part. And I totally regret it. And I did so out of being cowed into a false sense of patriotism after 9/11. Wow. And I thought I couldn't do it. And I wanted to run for president. And I took a politically expedient vote. And that was wrong. And then looked over at Hillary Clinton and said, can you say the same thing? And Hillary Clinton equivocated. And when clearly she should have said the exact same thing, right? So I was super impressed with the way in which he conducted his campaign publicly in 2007. I was an Edwards supporter. Rumors came out in the National Enquirer in December of 2007 that he was having an affair with Riel Hunter, who's a video documentarian that was following the campaign around. The campaign denied it. That was kind of it. But Edwards' strategy was basically to win Iowa and then, slingshot from there. He finished in second in the Iowa caucuses, losing to Barack Obama 37.5-30, which was perceived as a massive disappointment. And he dropped out immediately after that. It is obviously not hard to imagine that, particularly in a caucus format, that those kind of rumors may have made the difference at the margins between winning and not. So that was the background conditions. And then through investigative journalism, it was discovered he drops out of the race. And then after Obama has the nomination, I believe in August of 2008, a journalist spots him with Riel Hunter. He kind of breaks down and cries. And then they put together all this evidence that it was in fact true.
Wow.
And so those are the comparable facts. Now let's start at why this is a terrible argument. it's a terrible argument because John Edwards was indicted by a grand jury.
And yeah, I was going to say, what is the argument? You're assuming, yeah. So someone is using this to say, John Edwards got away with something, yeah. So therefore Trump's fine. Is that the...
Literally the only argument can be Edwards got away with it, so Trump should get away. So what's the big deal? And the answer is, right, Edwards got away with it for the reasons that I'm about to go into. But I mean, he was indicted, right? If you want to tell me we can indict Donald Trump, but a jury will acquit him, okay. Right.
same thing with the Clinton comparison. It's like, oh, so it's the same as Clinton. So at the very least, the House should be impeaching Trump any minute then.
Right. Right.
If it's the same, which I don't accept, but right. If it were.
And so this is close, but I'm going to give the one relevant factual difference right now, which is that had to do with the nature of the scheme. So the allegation is that Edwards secretly communicated with rich donors to pay off Riel Hunter directly, right? And that instead of, essentially that he wasn't stupid enough to do this himself and sign a document saying that he was doing it. So Edwards then maintained plausible deniability that he had no idea that his donors were paying off Riel Hunter and that they must have just, they were diehard campaign supporters who were just doing it on their own to try and make a problem go away. And there was actually some evidence introduced of that, right? Like there were conversations between low-level Edwards staffers and prominent donors. There was basically a gaffe in the 2008 primaries where John Edwards was, it was revealed that he got $400 haircuts.
I remember.
Yeah, that. Yeah. So it was a big news story. And then one of the campaign donors sent an email to one of the staffers and was like, I'm happy to pay for John Edwards' haircuts in the future if it means that, he doesn't show up on the news as, getting a $400 haircut. So Edwards maintained this plausible deniability of, I had no idea that my rich donors were paying her all this money. I think that probably isn't a great excuse. Note, by the way, that's what Trump tried to do from the outset, right? He tried to say, I had no idea. Michael Cohen just silences people all the time. The difference is in the Edwards case, ultimately, there was no smoking gun, right? The government was unable to show direct communications between Edwards and his staffers or Edwards and the donors. And so the jury acquitted on one count that involved a 100-year-old donor it's comical, but we don't need to go into it. And they deadlocked on the other five counts. And I'm going to link the ABC News reporting from 2011, but they polled the jurors and the jurors were like, we just don't think the government presented enough evidence. So Teresa Fuller said, I just felt like the evidence wasn't there. It could have been more. It could have been a lot more than what it was. That's that. I also thought this was a great jumping off point to plug our Laud Awful Movies, which should have dropped by the time this show drops.
Absolutely.
Which is 12 Angry Men, the classic.
Yes.
And you asked me a question in the middle of us doing 12 Angry Men about how courts resolve when jurors say that they are deadlocked. And I talked a little bit parenthetically about the Allen charge. The jury in the Edwards case was also given an Allen charge, and I got something a little bit wrong about that. So I thought it would be fun for the entire audience to unpack what an Allen charge is. And if you want to hear me get that wrong, you've got to be a patron and listen to us hilariously making fun of and appreciating simultaneously 12 Angry Men. So I had mused, because it's our comedy show and I do less research for our comedy show, not zero, but less. I had mused that maybe...
Yeah, sometimes you do extensive research on little rabbit trails. It's selective, extensive research.
It's fun. But 12 Angry Men was filmed in 1956, aired in 1957. And so I had mused, maybe they didn't have Allen charges back in 1957. Turns out the Allen charge, and again, if I were a criminal lawyer, I would have known this, but I'm not, so I didn't. The Allen charge dates back to Allen versus United States, which is an 1896 Supreme Court decision. So, you know, I was only off by 60 years.
So not all the
years.
Some of the actors in the movie had been born, by the way.
Yeah, but some had not. Yeah. Some predate them.
Some hadn't been born, but some had been born already.
And that case stands for the proposition that it is permissible for a judge to issue a jury instruction to tell a jury that comes back and says we're deadlocked to tell the minority to compromise. And here is the text. And again, with some modifications for the archaic nature of the language, this is what a judge will read today if a jury comes back and says we're deadlocked. Members of the jury, I'm going to ask that you continue your deliberations in an effort to reach agreement upon a verdict and dispose of this case. And I have a few additional comments I would like for you to consider as you do so. This is an important case. The trial has been expensive in time, effort, money, and emotional strain to both the defense and the prosecution. If you should fail to reach a verdict, the case will be left open and may have to be tried again. Obviously, another trial would serve only to increase the cost on both sides, and there is no reason to believe that the case could be tried again by either side any better or more exhaustively than it has been tried before you. Any future jury will be selected in the same manner and from the same source as you were chosen, and there's no reason to believe that the case could ever be submitted to 12 men and women more conscientious, more impartial, or more competent to decide it, or that more clear evidence could be produced. And again, I'll do parenthetical, even in 1896, that includes women, although 12 angry men did not. Back to the text of the charge. If a substantial majority of your number are in favor of a conviction, those of you who disagree should reconsider whether your doubt is a reasonable one, since it appears to make no effective impression upon the minds of the others. On the other hand, if a majority or even a lesser number of you are in favor of an acquittal, the rest of you should ask yourselves again and most thoughtfully whether you should accept the weight and sufficiency of the evidence, which fails to convince your fellow jurors beyond a reasonable doubt. Remember at all times that no juror is expected to give up an honest belief that he or she may have as to the weight or the effect of the evidence, but after full deliberation and consideration of the evidence in the case, it is your duty to agree upon a verdict if you can do so. You must also remember that if the evidence in the case fails to establish guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, the defendant should have your unanimous verdict of not guilty. You may be as leisurely in your deliberations as the occasion may require and should take all the time which you may feel is necessary. So that's a shout out to Pauly Shore in Jury Duty. And then concludes with, I ask now that you retire once again and continue your deliberations with these additional comments in mind to be applied, of course, in conjunction with all of the other instructions I have previously given to you. And so that's an Allen charge. A court can either do that sua sponte, that is, on its own if the jury comes back and says we're deadlocked, or if the jury has just been out for a long time. Alternatively, either lawyer may request an Allen charge if the jury has just been out in deliberations a long time and has not come back with a verdict. So that's what we mean by that. That's what courts do to try and encourage juries to move towards unanimity or move towards, if you're in a state in which unanimity is not required, to move towards a verdict.
Does that apply here, or you just wanted to correct what you said in Lot Awful Movies?
I wanted to correct what I said in Lot Awful Movies, and I wanted to mention that in the Edwards case, that Allen charge was given, and the jury still came back and said, yep, you told us to try and agree if we could, but we can't. And again, so I think that underscores exactly how fact intensive the Edwards case was, right? And I do not see how this is a good analogy for Donald Trump at all. Edwards, like I said, had six counts. He was charged with conspiracy to violate the election laws under 18 U.S.C. 371. He was charged with four counts of accepting illegal campaign contributions. And he was charged with making false statements to the FEC under 18 U.S.C. 1001. And it seems to me that all of those charges apply with equal force to the Donald Trump Stormy Daniels. And as we have gone on at great length, there's no... when you have said in open court that I was the beneficiary to this settlement agreement, it is really difficult to say, but I had no idea what it was about. So
there you go. So we'll have to see how the jury comes out on that one. No, we're a long way from that. All right. Well, thanks, Patron Thaddeus, for that question. Thanks to everybody who participated in the Q&A. Like I said, super fun. And if you're a patron, you can catch the audio after the fact. All right, Andrew, more on the NFL. We've got some follow-up questions that people had. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, so I think there were two big stories that came out after we did our show with Chris Christofko, which I think was great. I stand by everything that we said, but people wanted to kind of drill down a little bit. So on Tuesday, what we said was basically the real question about this policy is going to come down to how the NFL tried to skirt around the players' collective bargaining agreement and how the players' association is going to respond. I think that's entirely correct. I remain very, very confident that that there is not an independent legal challenge outside of that. But people are asking questions. So first question comes to us from a longtime friend of the show, Michael Rops, and a bunch of other people. And it involves a story that came down from the website Pro Football Talk, which is associated with NBC Sports, and longtime NFL commentator and journalist Mike Florio, who said
it's good website if you want the latest football news, that's for sure.
Yeah, I go there all the time. And so Florio's story is that Jerry Jones, who those of you who listened to our Chris Cluey episode may remember that he opined really strongly. I thought this was super interesting and great, kind of sharing some inside knowledge with us, that the ownership group is dominated by Jerry Jones, and that there are a couple holdouts, but essentially what Jerry Jones wants, he gets. And this story, I think, strongly corroborates that, and is Jones, who's 297 years old, frothing off at the mouth about how Donald Trump made it clear that he was not going to let the anthem issue go and that he wanted the NFL owners to do something about it. And so the question was, in light of that story, in light of the fact that Donald Trump is pushing for this, does that either make it a First Amendment issue, or does that potentially violate 18 U.S.C. 227? Apparently, that is making the liberal rounds. So let's tackle that one first, because that's a clear and hard no. The president has the power of the bully pulpit, and so long as there is no evidence of pressuring the legislature or an executive agency or otherwise undertaking an official act, the fact that he called up Jerry Jones and really, really wants the NFL to do something about it, in my view, does not convert this into anything that is remotely potentially actionable. So it's not unconstitutional. Is it illegal? Does it violate that statute? That statute says, I'm going to read it to you, whoever, being a covered government person, which is defined as including the president, with the intent to influence solely on the basis of partisan political affiliation, an employment decision or employment practice of any private entity, takes or withholds or offers or threatens to take or withhold an official act, or influences or offers or threatens to influence the official act of another, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned for not more than 15 years or both.
Just as a warm-up TTB question, that doesn't sound like it applies.
Yeah, it plainly doesn't apply a whole bunch of reasons.
All right, add that to my score. I got it right.
Yeah, you clearly got that got that correct. We could drill down about what an official act is. We've talked about that before, but Donald Trump didn't take any official act. He didn't threaten legislation. He didn't, right?
Also, it said partisan there. It wasn't really based on like, I'm going to punish Democrats. It was based on some other thing that's not exactly a partisan, like one side or the other.
Yep.
It's just an issue that correlates.
Exactly right. And so I went to Lexis to try and figure out how strictly that solely on the basis of partisan political affiliation provision is construed. And I don't have an answer, because in the history of humanity, there are only three cases that have ever cited this statute. One cited it as a typo because somebody was accidentally indicted under this statute and it was a 2 instead of an 8. One cited it in dismissing a pro se nonsense complaint where somebody tried to file a civil lawsuit and wanted damages and basically said, this is a criminal statute. You don't get money damages for that. And the third one cited it in a string cite as an example of when Congress makes explicit sole intentionality statutes, right? As an example of something to be construed strictly. So it is entirely possible, right? There are two possibilities here. It is entirely possible no one has ever been prosecuted under this law. It's that narrow. Mm-hmm. That is a possibility. It is also a possibility. I want to be 100% clear about this. It is also a possibility that everybody who gets prosecuted under this statute immediately pleads out and that you know, therefore there's no case record because, you know, it's crystal clear. Possible, but it is also possible that that no one has ever been prosecuted under the statute. Yeah, mm-hmm. The plain reading is you would have to show that, you know, your local congressman calls up the business and says, hey, you got to fire Sally here and hire Jenna because, you know, she's a Democrat and I'm a Democrat. Right. And if you don't do that, you'll never have access to my office again. And unless you say those words in that order, a la Beavis and Butthead, then it's going to be really, really hard to bring a case under the statute.
Yeah, maybe if we got a hold of the Michael Cohen tapes, this case might exist somewhere. Yeah, but it doesn't seem like it exists here.
Right. Okay, so that's the Trump encouraged it part. But what about, we got a couple of questions about the fact that these are publicly financed stadiums in which the teams are playing. And so doesn't that kind of make it like a public forum? We've talked about the public forum doctrine.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I could see, you know, there might be some potential to that question.
Yeah, I absolutely think that it's an interesting question. So I want to make an even stronger case than what anybody has said so far. And the way in which I'm going to make that case is by plugging Opening Arguments episode number 108, which I'll link in the show notes. And in that case,
but I'm already envisioning, like, if you work for Verizon and Verizon has an employee, some sort of, you know, like big employee meeting or something at a public, like, theater, you know, like a government-owned, city-owned theater, and like, therefore, and then whoever's the Verizon spokesman, oh, it's not that guy anymore, he moved to Sprint. Well, whatever. Somebody who works for Verizon jumps on and just says a bunch of nonsense. It's not like they can't fire that person because he said it in a public space. Is that at all analogous?
I think you're on the right track with respect to that. Okay. So let's make the public space argument and public financing even stronger, right? So in episode 108, we talked about the Senators McCain and Flake from Arizona, their report on tackling paid patriotism. That report showed that from 2012 to 2016, the U.S. Department of Defense spent $6.8 million on sports marketing contracts. So that included things like paying the Atlanta Falcons to welcome home National Guard members who then unfurled an American flag in the Georgia Dome. And that report says in the précis, unsuspecting audience members became the subjects of paid marketing campaigns rather than simply bearing witness to teams' authentic, voluntary shows of support for the brave men and women who wear our nation's uniform. This not only betrays the sentiment and trust of fans, but casts an unfortunate shadow over the genuine patriotic partnerships that do so much for our troops, such as the National Football League's Salute to the Service campaign. In the end, 2/3 of the contracts found by our offices or reported by the DOD contain some form of paid patriotism. Direct and persistent sunlight is the best way to ensure that such activities are not continued. It is time to allow major sports teams' legitimate tributes to our soldiers to shine with national pride rather than being cast under the pallor of marketing gimmicks paid for by American taxpayers. So there is direct payments from the government to NFL teams to engage in these paid patriotic activities. I will flag, right, this is not, Dennis Kucinich writing these reports. These are two conservative Republican senators from Arizona, John McCain. We all know his war background. And I would hope that everybody could get behind the idea that the government shouldn't surreptitiously sponsor fake patriotic events on the NFL field. So
let's stop the stupid anthems.
Right. So not only are they paying in publicly funded stadium, but they're getting government money. They're direct contracts with the U.S. government. So doesn't this bring this under the First Amendment? And let me make one more analogy, right? If this were the University of Maryland, right? If this were a public school, this would be a First Amendment violation. Because there's no question that the NFL policy, if the First Amendment were to apply, and again, I want to be 100% clear, mm-hmm. the First Amendment does not apply. But if it did, it would be viewpoint discrimination, right? The way in which it's worded is designed to suppress one kind of viewpoint.
Right. That part seems absolutely clear.
So then the question is, does the First Amendment apply? And the issue here is the state action doctrine. And I realize that we've never really formally discussed how that applies, right? We've said, oh, it's state action. That means the government has to do it, or the government has to be doing it through a private party. But I thought it might be worth unpacking that a little bit to kind of talk about what that means. So there are really two ways in which, right, it's clear, if the government does it, we know what it means when the government does it. Right? But there are two ways in which private parties get swept up into the ambit of the First Amendment. The first is what we call the public function doctrine. And that is, a private entity must comply with the Constitution if it is performing a task that has been traditionally and exclusively done by the government. And the case here, and I really want our listener, if you like reading cases, go out and read this case. I'm going to link it in the show notes. It's called Marsh versus Alabama. It's from 1946, and it's about a company town, right? So it's like the Globex town from The Simpsons, right? Where in a company town, what happens is the company buys up all the land and then leases back, you know, homes and retail shops, and, you know, everybody in this town works for that company. And so it's all technically private property. So Marsh, 1946 case, right? Not exactly the heyday of expanding individual rights, but involved Jehovah's Witnesses who wanted to distribute their tracts on the street of this company town. And the Globex Corporation said, no, we own this town. We've got a no trespassing, you know, get the hell out. And the Supreme Court said, no, if you run an entire town, then the First Amendment is going to apply even though you have personal property rights. And what the Supreme Court specifically said is, the more an owner, for his advantage, opens up his property for use by the public in general, the more do his rights become circumscribed by the statutory and constitutional rights of those who use it. And this is an interesting case for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's neat reading the way in which cases were decided before originalism crept into our jurisprudence. Mm. So, you know, it's an old-timey case, but it's not so old-timey that it's impenetrable. It's nice and short. and this case gets cited in all of the, is Facebook a public forum, you know, our social media. It gets cited and distinguished in those kinds of cases. So clearly, NFL stadia are not public forum under the Marsh versus Alabama rule, right? It very clearly doesn't meet that criteria, but that's the primary way in which private parties wind up having the First Amendment applied to them. The second way, and this is the only other way to get the NFL to apply, is what we call the entanglement exception, which is that private conduct must comply with the Constitution if the government has authorized, encouraged, or facilitated the unconstitutional conduct. And this stems from a case called Burton versus Wilmington Parking Authority from 1961. And almost all of these cases are racial discrimination cases. So in this case, you had a privately owned restaurant. It's 1961, so it is before the Civil Rights Act. It was located in a public parking garage, and they had the sadly common at the time no Negroes sign and were relying on their private property rights to exclude African Americans from eating at the restaurant. And the question was, are you on private property? Are you sufficiently entangled with actions of the government such that you can be considered a public actor? And the court held yes. And the rule that they crafted in that case is, where the state has, quote, so far insinuated itself into a position of interdependence with a private non-state actor, that must be recognized as a joint participant in the challenged activity. Having a public parking lot with a restaurant attached to it was considered public activity. But the 1961 case very specifically says that it needs to be adjudicated on a case-by-case basis. The court says, because readily applicable formulae may not be fashioned, the conclusions drawn from the facts and circumstances of this record are by no means declared as universal truths on the basis of which every state leasing agreement is to be tested. Owing to the very largeness of government, a multitude of relationships might appear to some to fall within the amendment's embrace, but that, must be remembered, can only be determined in the framework of the peculiar facts or circumstances present. So after that, 1961, then we have the Civil Rights Act that applies to places of public accommodation. And then the Supreme Court curtails the scope of this case quite a bit in the 1970s. So in 1972, there was a private club that had a policy of racial discrimination, and the court held that just because that club got a liquor license, right, was authorized by the state to serve alcohol, did not constitute sufficient state involvement, state entanglement. Right. And in 1974, there was a private utility company. And again, the court said that despite the fact that the state licensed the utility, extensively regulated the utility, that did not rise to the level of significant state involvement. So from that history, I think it is very, very clear. I think it is motion to dismiss levels of clear that just the connection between having some tax breaks for building the stadiums and having some of these paid patriotic programs does not constitute significant state involvement, such as to make the NFL a private institution into a state actor.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. And the only thing I want to go out on here is I will link in the show notes. I talked about this in the Facebook community, which if you have not been to facebook.com/group/Yodel Mountain, you should head on over there. It's a lot of fun. Somebody posted an article from Ben Sachs, who I don't believe was at Harvard while I was there, but he is a Harvard law professor. And he wrote an article for Vox called "It's Obviously Illegal." And now, again, keeping in mind that most authors don't get to choose their title, so he might not be responsible for the title. That is not. I couldn't disagree more strongly with Professor Sachs. He raises four arguments in that article. The first is the CBA, with which we agree, right? So that's not a point. The second is the free speech issue. We just talked about that. The third is an argument about labor law, in which he cites to Epic Systems. That's the case we talked about on Tuesday, and says, it seems like this could be concerted workplace activity. There's no way to draw that conclusion from Epic Systems, right? I mean, we just went through it, right? The majority opinion in Epic Systems narrowed the definition of what constitutes concerted workplace activity, and I can't see anybody drawing that connection, even though, you know, read super expansively, you might say that this is a kind of concerted workplace activity. But I don't know that I would buy that either, right? Because concerted workplace activity is directed at the employment conditions of the employees, right? Like, you engage in collective bargaining or striking or litigation to make your workplace conditions better. This is concerted workplace activity in the form of protesting greater social injustice, right? So I don't think it's a good argument without Epic Systems. It's a terrible argument with Epic Systems. And his conclusion, I think, really kind of says it all. He says, applying the Constitution in this context, meaning free speech, is justified, but would require judges to break some new legal ground. Look, it's reasonable to do that. Like, we've talked about how, you know, law review articles left and right can break new legal ground and can shape the discourse. But, you know, if you're arguing to break new legal ground, make that argument, right? Say it should. Right.
Yeah,
we should read it.
This is disappointing that a Vox article, you know, I'm a fan of Vox, but like, what? Yeah. That's not obviously illegal.
Well, and now let me go out on something that I think is going to push every single one of your buttons, and we'll figure out, you'll see why in 8 seconds. But even if the courts refuse to apply the Constitution directly here, the players ought to have at their disposal another powerful legal tool. The law of most states declares that employers may not fire or otherwise discipline employees for reasons that violate the state's public policies. It is hard to imagine a public policy in whatever state you choose more important than the policy in favor of free speech on matters of public concern. Thoughts?
Wouldn't all this apply to James Damore?
You're not looking at my notes. That's what I have next on my line in the notes. Yeah. This is not only wrong, but dangerous. As we talked about in the Damore lawsuit, the doctrine of firing that violates public policy is for violating the kind of protected conduct, right? So there are cases like, and again, Professor Sachs knows this and mentions it in his article, right? There are cases about, you can't fire somebody because they served jury duty. You can't fire somebody for refusing to perjure themselves on your behalf. Right. Those are the kinds of things that violate public policy. We do not want a rule that says employers cannot fire an employee on the basis of their political beliefs. So I think the article is it's wrong in that it implies that the law is this way. And as an argument for changing the law, I am distinctly not persuaded on either legal or political grounds. So there we go.
Yeah, definitely. I think that there might be a lot of liberal hypocrisy on this one. We got to make sure we're keeping it right. I, for one, as I alluded to earlier, I think we should protest the NFL for doing something really stupid, not because it's illegal, but because it's something I personally think it's petty and just that's the main thing. It's so petty to take this action against people who merely kneeled for 5 seconds. Like, it's just. Anyway,
yeah,
all right.
I think we should be honest about that, right? Like, this is a conversation we had in the Facebook community. I am not opposed to the NFL's policy on independent free speech grounds, right? I don't want players to be able to say whatever they want in accordance with the First Amendment on the field. I'm opposed to the policy because I'd like for the NFL to be more progressive. I'd like for it to be more of a force for good. And, you know, we have documented that it has been entangled with this, you know, paid patriotism kind of stuff. And so I oppose it on the substance that I agree with what Colin Kaepernick was doing, right? So, you know, it's not, I just think it's, we want to be careful when you're talking about making the liberal argument, not to get bogged down. It's not a free speech argument, right? Make the argument on the substance. Say, I like the fact that a minority quarterback decided to use his platform to draw attention to social justice issues in precisely the way that we think people ought to protest, right? Peaceful, attention gathering, highlighting an issue, and it seems petty and wrong to retaliate against that and to highlight that. Make the argument on those grounds. Don't make the arguments on the legal grounds.
All right. Well, thanks for the breakdown and the follow-up. On with the rest of the show.
I'm asking you if you know the difference between right and wrong.
All right. Andrew, were you maybe wrong? Is this Andrew was wrong?
Yeah. This is an Andrew was maybe wrong. It's I'm trying to bury that. This is also a semi Yodel Mountain segment. So we'll see which one of us Brian likes better by determining what he played in the intro segment. I will remind Brian that you fired him at the beginning of this episode.
Since I fired him early on, I feel like my odds are not looking good.
So if he still picks you, that will tell you Brian's regard for me on the show.
Yeah. Hold on. I fired him, true, but he had to deal with a lot of stuff about your audio quality.
Yeah, there we go. Last few episodes, yeah. All right. So listeners will know the answer to this question before we do. So Yodel Mountainy, first, it's been kind of a slow Yodel Mountain week. I'm going to link two articles in the show notes. The one that I referred to last week is the New York Times flowchart, and the second is a Politico narrative. It doesn't have the flowchart attached, but both I think are really, really good analyses of what the Mueller investigation is going to do next, because we keep getting asked those questions. And from a political standpoint, I don't think I can do any better than either of those. I'm really, really curious. The Politico article is written by Nelson Cunningham. It only came out a couple days ago. He is a former prosecutor who worked under Rudy Giuliani. And I am curious what our pal Randall Eliason thinks of it. It seems right to me, but I encourage Randall to shoot us a message and let us know what he thinks. So that's, right. That's the political context. From a legal context, the big news this week concerned Michael Cohen and his pending lawsuit in the Southern District of New York. And let me again set the stage. What's pending in the Southern District of New York? Michael Cohen has not yet been indicted, but every judge seems to think that he will be. Michael Cohen filed a lawsuit, a motion for a temporary restraining order against the U.S. government, seeking to force the government to give him back the documents that were seized from his law office during the FBI's raid that was authorized via search warrant. Right. So this proceeding that we're about to talk about it's not a criminal proceeding. It is a civil proceeding brought by Michael Cohen through counsel to get his stuff back. And, you know, in our Taint Team episode, we talked about how the court has undertaken some steps to try and preserve the integrity of the judicial system while still responding to Michael Cohen. The other thing that was pending that we have talked about is that Stormy Daniels moved to intervene in those proceedings. And as part of moving to intervene, right, that is to come in as a third party who says, I have interests in the outcome of this litigation that may not adequately be protected by either party that is presently in this lawsuit. And as part of that pending motion to intervene, Michael Avenatti petitioned the court to appear pro hac vice. And after going through his pro hac petition, the opposition that was filed by Michael Cohen's lawyers, who I called out as very fine lawyers, and the response by Avenatti, I said two things. I said, number one, the overwhelming weight of the law sure seems like the court is going to admit him pro hac vice, but number two, that it is committed to the sound discretion of the trial court, and that if the trial judge, Kimball Wood, denies Avenatti's motion to appear pro hac vice, there's really nothing that Avenatti will be able to do about it. And earlier this week, Avenatti, they had a hearing on Avenatti's motion to appear pro hac vice, and it did not go well for Mr. Avenatti. The Judge Wood was openly critical of Mr. Avenatti's efforts to try the case in the media, and her comment was, you will need to stop your publicity tour if you're going to involve yourself in this case. I say publicity tour, not in a derogatory sense. You're entitled to publicity. I can't stop you unless you're participating in a matter before me. So in response to that hearing, as any smart lawyer would, Michael Avenatti withdrew his motion to appear pro hac vice. I'm going to attach that withdrawal. It's a one-line statement. And what it says is,
it says, you'll never take the spotlight away from me.
What it actually says is that I'm going to withdraw this
my
motion.
My public needs me.
Yeah.
I cannot. I withdraw. I will never give up the spotlight. That's what it says, right?
Not quite.
Okay.
Instead, what it says is, I'm withdrawing this motion without prejudice, right? That means I reserve the right to file it again as unnecessary because my client's motion to intervene is currently being held in abeyance, right? That is that the court has not addressed that issue yet. And so when it goes to address that issue, and look, the reason the court is not addressing that issue is because the court has to figure out whether this case is going to be consolidated with a criminal indictment, which everybody thinks is coming. So court hasn't ruled and isn't in the process of ruling on whether to admit Stormy Daniels via joinder to the case. So Michael Avenatti doesn't have to appear until the court takes that up. And so he said, you know what? I'm not going to talk about this right now. I'm going to go away and I'll refile this at another point in time. I think it's important to talk about this for a couple of reasons. Number one, accountable, right? I predicted the court was going to grant it, and I was wrong on that. Number two, I've seen a lot of sources, including ordinarily reliable sources, that have described this as withdrawing the motion to intervene. And that's not true. Stormy Daniels still has a pending motion to intervene.
It's
in
just
the Cohen
a different
case.
Lawyer is going
to. Yeah, that's
it
right. Yeah, you can. Yeah. And to be honest, right? Like, what I think Avenatti is going to do is try and show the judge, hey, look, you told me not to do a publicity tour. I withdrew my motion. And then at whatever point that comes up, if it's been weeks or months, he'll say, look, I've been a good boy since then. You can trust me. It's what I would do, right? And the court is then going to have to choose between.
Andrew, you media whore.
And then the court is going to have to choose whether to consider the motion and let Stormy Daniels have the lawyer of her choice represent her in that court, or whether it will consider the motion and force her to get another lawyer. But, you know, look, there are a lot of lawyers in New York. So you know, having been burned once, I'm not going to say that the court, you know, will be moved by that. But this is the best thing, right? Like when you get your butt kicked by a judge at a hearing, you want to show the court, you know, message received, and I'm going to comply with what the court is trying to tell me to do. We learned a couple of other really, really interesting things in connection with this hearing. So we talked about the taint team. We talked about how this in this proceeding, Judge Wood.
We don't talk enough about the taint team.
I know. Reassigned the taint review outside of the Southern District of New York and to Judge Barbara Jones, a former partner of mine, who is completing the privilege review of those documents. And in connection with that, because the government turned over the documents to a third party for review, they also turned the documents over to Michael Cohen's lawyers, right? Like their objection to this TRO was Michael Cohen initially wanted the documents back with nobody keeping any copies. And the government was like, yeah, I don't think we're going to do that. And so as part of the hearing, the government indicated that in addition to turning 3.7 million documents over to Michael Cohen's lawyers, that they were turning over, quote, the contents of a shredding machine, end quote. And this is something the computer science is really, really good at reconstructing shredded documents. You can get a forensic analyst who will do that. If Michael Cohen spoliated evidence related to Donald Trump, that would be a huge development. We have no evidence of that. I do not want to say that we do. I want to say if he did, that would be a big, big deal. And in connection with that, it is worth mentioning, this has happened last week, but Evgeny Friedman, who is a Russian immigrant known as the Taxi King and who is a business partner of Michael Cohen, has flipped, is cooperating with the Southern District.
I think it's a bad sign when your business partners have nicknames.
Yeah.
What I mean? Like, if someone's like, who's your business partner? Well, Andrew Torres.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh, he's the Taxi King.
The Taxi King, right. Andrew Torres, the Taxi King of Maryland. Are you kidding me? I love that guy.
It's not a good sign is all I'm saying. It's not a good sign.
Yeah. And again, look, we have to try and read the tea leaves here, but, Mr. Friedman, who was a lawyer, and was disbarred, was nevertheless in partnership with Michael Cohen in Cohen's taxi business scheme, not in his law firm. Right. So there is zero connection to the matters for which we presume Michael Cohen will soon be under indictment. Mr. Friedman's scheme was New York City had this 50-cent tax that was supposed to go to road improvements, and apparently he was pocketing it. So, you know, he defrauded the taxpayers out of a whole bunch of money related to taxi fares. Again, typically the reason you do that is because nobody thinks that Michael Cohen had any involvement in the taxi scheme either, right? He's not a taxi guy. You get the Taxi King to do that. The reason to do that is because you think that person is going to flip on Michael Cohen and knows where the bodies are buried. So let's keep our eyes open. A lot of stuff out there. There's one more rumor. I went back and read the original transcripts. People are reporting that the judge confirmed that there are audio recordings, that there are tapes between Cohen and Donald Trump. I don't read it that way. I read that as entertaining a hypothetical that there could be, that was raised by Michael Avenatti. So maybe there's more evidence that's come out since this morning, but I have not seen evidence that there are tapes, and I would be suspicious of any left-wing sources that are claiming, oh yeah, we know that there are tapes. I wouldn't say we know that they're tapes right now. It's a supposition that was raised by Avenatti, and we will have to wait to see what there are.
But oh lordy, I hope they're tapes.
Oh yeah, and last thing, right? So the court set a deadline of June 15th for both sides, and by both sides I mean the independent side of Judge Jones and Cohen's lawyers. So that is, you know, 2 weeks away to complete their privilege review. So 2 weeks from when you hear this, when you hear this episode, we will have the results of that privilege review. Cohen's lawyers asked for more time, and Judge Wood said no. Said, yeah, look, it seems to be going just fine from Judge Jones's office. So I don't understand why you guys aren't able to review the documents. And said, anything you can't review by June 15th, I'm going to deem non-privilege. I'm going to turn back over to the prosecutors.
This is a no-nonsense judge. This is a Judge Judy.
Yeah, this is absolutely kind of a don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining kind of judge.
I love Cohen's like, hey, we need 6 more years.
Yeah, I've only got one associate and, you know, he's really slow at reviewing your thing. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean,
2 to 6 more years, depending on
how things. And so what happens usually in this context, what will happen is that the attorneys for Michael Cohen will prepare a privilege log and will say, we are withholding the following documents on the basis of privilege. And then they have to turn that log over with sufficient identifying information to the government. And then the government will have to challenge those withholdings as privilege. What I do not know and what is not clear to me is whether there will be independent evaluation, prospective evaluation from Judge Jones and the Taint team. In other words, whether they can affirmatively look at it and will also prepare recommendations.
They drive
whether
their van in.
Yeah, and they open exactly,
the door. Right, yeah. And the Taint
team. Oh, that great music would play in the background. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah. So
what is the Taint team signal? Like that signal? No, I don't want to know.
Right. So that's what we're looking for. We will know more on that in 2 weeks.
All right. Well, very tangible timeline there. I can't wait. So 2 weeks from now, we're going to have an awesome Fast Response Friday. So cool. Thanks for the breakdown. And I know Andrew wasn't really wrong, but also Andrew was wrong. Yep. So definitely.
No. You're going to love this. Believe me. This is the greatest part of the program.
It's cool. Just cool. Nice.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for that breakdown of why you were probably wrong. And now we've got to go to our Hall of Famer patrons, our all-time greats. We've got so many to thank. Oh my gosh, I'm blown away. Patreon.com/law. I know everybody wants to get at that Lot Awful Movies number 19, 12 Angry Men. It was a lot of fun. We've got to thank, starting with I, Thomas Smith, hereby. I don't feel so good, Mr. Torres. We've got wordorigins.org, your guide to 13th century Saxon legal terms. Anonymous, NHL Seattle 2020, sharks beware. Yeah, well, we now know that expansion teams just are the best. If they messed up the rules, so it just becomes the all Madden team for the NHL. Put your analyst on danger money, baby.
That's another Zaphod quote. So,
oh, okay, yeah. Do them all you want because I will never get them. Last Chance to See by Douglas Adams is very underrated. Well, there you go.
It is. One. It really is.
The Poor Man's Drungo. The Poor Man's Drungo Hazewood of the San Jose Sharks. Drungo. Awesome. I love this segment. It's like my favorite segment. This Week in News with Kevin Benedict. Don't drown in your data like the Terminator. Go to alloyit.com. Awesome. Elizabeth Warren is trying to starve my friends via EBHTA. Mike, the Intactivist. Matthew Vernon. Heather Leverage. Aaron Gulliver. Aaron Grady. Adam Lenda. Alec Emke. 4 of 20 tertiary adjunct of Unimatrix 69. This space intentionally left blank. Hey, Matt and Rose, become patrons, you cheapskates.
Yeah, we have not seen Matt and Rose yet, so get on that.
Well, yeah, or they have a really clever name, so that could maybe they.
Yeah, if so, our apologies. Yeah. Thank you, Matt and Rose.
Brian Upshaw's Last Chance for Profit Prison. Benjamin Crumb, Soggy Pants, Foxhole Atheist. The OA theme song sounds better at 1.5x. Sam Dinow, Eli Bosnick. I need to remember to change my name before Thursday. Looks like you forgot. Teresa Gomez, Greg Jeskowitz, www.serversideswift.co.uk, freelance software developer. Cool. Yusuke Urameshi, Ian and Ali, Make America Great Within 2 Tries. Make America Great Within 2 Tries, Thomas Smith for President 2020.
Oh.
Yeah, guaranteed, it might not be the first thing I do, but like the second thing I do. Oh, that's funny. Dave rooting for the sinkhole nickel. Jim, we didn't even cover the legality of the sinkhole. Jim Grove, James English, the law offices of Lunkwill and Fook, Jordan Galash, Rear Admiral Lieutenant General Keith, Kevin Graham, Thomas the Second Chance Law Firm survived Infinity War, and Soul. Whew, thank you guys. That's just mine. Andrew, you got to get to yours.
Yeah, thank you too. Malika Chandler, to Lags-a-Lot, to a string of unpronounceable characters, to Bigglesby, Wigglesby, Jigglesby, Gigglesby, Flipperty Flapperty, yay. Andrew and Thomas always know where their towels are. Thank you to Impeachment in 25 Weeks, had the Cold War, now the Cold Civil War. Oof. Lamb, the First Purge. Time is an illusion, lunchtime doubly so. Thank you to Squickthinger. Thank you to a classic, campquest.org, campquest.org, campquest.org. Yeah. Thanks to Tricicular Manslaughter, Buttercup's Legal Services, actual legal advice from an actual cat. Thank you to Philip Stromberg, the Wayward Willis podcast, Occam's Chainsaw Massacre. Thanks to Adopt a Homeless Pet and Opposed Declawing and Ear Docking. Thanks to our first patron, Danny Rosari. Thanks to Reagan Klein, Rhonda the Dork, Roger, but the sign said all you could eat Metcalf versus Frying Dutchman, Roger, Seasick Sarah, Trump Run Undone wants lump sum funds to dumb tongue sea sun. Thanks to Pete Rose for President 2020. Oh my gosh.
Hey, there's no reason he can't be. That doesn't violate your sincerely held religious belief.
There's no rule that says a dog can't play basketball. So thanks to In Loco Parentis, King Leon, God of the Aboriginals, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense. But lady, I'm flying a spaceship. Thanks to either Thomas or Andrew, died at the end of Infinity War. Still haven't seen it, man. It's going to leave the theaters and I'm not going to get there. Thanks to Beth can't think of anything particularly clever right now. Rob Schreck. Thanks to Sakashite Fukasumi's heart going like mad. And yes, I said, yes, I will. Yes. Thanks to Frederick Alstromer. Thanks to Michael Cohen's tape recorder. Oh, God, you won't believe the stuff I've heard. Thanks to Eighth Amendment Advocate. Stop breaking the law, asshole.
I feel like
his
tape recorder would be a lot of him trying to do, like, comedy and impressions, like, just while it's going. Like, you know what I mean? Don't you feel like he would just be like, hey, so here I'm trying out my impression of Jimmy Stewart. Oh, you're the last order of the moon. You know, just a bunch of nonsense that like he thinks is funny.
Oh my gosh, Ben Stiller's career is already taken another uptick due to his masterful SNL portrayal of Michael Cohen. But that would just be fantastic if it gave him new material. Okay, thanks to Stop Breaking the Law, asshole. Liz is raising money for kids with cancer. Check the profile link. That is our buddy Liz Weeks. Thanks to Mitchell. Dave is tired of living in the dumbest timeline. You and me both, brother. Thanks to people said I was dumb, but I proved them. Thanks to Kim Kardashian's glamorous private prisons. And finally, thanks to our top patron, Conrad Michaels. Woo! Thanks to all of you. We really appreciate it. This is what makes the show, the rapid response, everything possible. And we cannot express our appreciation enough.
No kidding. All right. It is time for and my second chance presidency.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
It is time for TTTTBE. And I know I got that miracle one a couple of weeks ago, but I think last week I got wrong. But let's see if I can recover. Let's have it.
All right. So this is an evidence question. In a civil trial for professional malpractice, the plaintiff sought to show that the defendant, an engineer, had designed the plaintiff's flour mill with inadequate power. The plaintiff called an expert witness who based his testimony solely on his own professional experience, but also asserted, when asked, that the book Smith on Milling Systems was a reliable treatise in the field and consistent with his views.
This question better ask about flour power.
On cross-examination, the defendant asked the witness whether he and Smith were ever wrong. The witness answered, well, nobody's perfect. The defendant asked no further questions. So good job, defense lawyer there. Defense attorney Michael Cohen, I think. The defendant later called his own expert witness and asked, do you accept the Smith book as reliable? The witness said, it once was, but it is now badly out of date. The plaintiff requested that the jury be allowed to examine the book and judge for itself the book's reliability. Should the court allow the jury to examine the book? Your answers. A, no, because the jury may consider only passages read to it by counsel or by a witness. B, No, because the plaintiff's expert did not rely on the treatise in his testimony, but on his own experience. C, yes, because an expert has testified that the treatise is reliable. Or D, yes, because the jury is the judge of the weight and credibility to be accorded both written and oral evidence.
Well, this is incredibly weird. I feel like there's no way this would be the way you evaluate it. Like, what if what would you really have a jury read a book on flour milling and they could decide, what are they going to use their milling expertise to decide? But I don't understand. That seems really odd, but I guess we'll just have to see which answer makes sense. Man, this is a really weird question. Right now I'm leaning toward no, because the plaintiff's expert did not rely on the treatise, because he testified. It says here that the plaintiff called an expert witness who based his testimony solely on his own professional experience. But then he also like happened to say that this book is a reliable book. And then the defendant decides to bring on his own expert witness that says that book isn't reliable. So like, it really doesn't seem like that matters. You know, like the expert used his own professional experience. I mean, I guess by proxy, it's kind of a way of evaluating whether or not the expert is right. But this is incredibly confusing to me. So I'll just try to eliminate two here. I would say there's no way the jury reading the book, how are they going to know how are they possibly going to evaluate whether the book is reliable by reading it? I don't understand. They don't have any background milling knowledge that you're relying on. I don't get how any yes answer could possibly be true. So I'm just going to be bold, and this is going to get me. It's going to be a trick question. I'm just going to eliminate both those yes questions. And I'm going to go with B, and I'm excited to be wrong on this one. I'm sure it'll be some nonsense 13th century Saxony law where the jury, I mean, I guess, yeah, maybe it's possible the plaintiff could successfully request that they examine it, but I don't understand why that would possibly be the best way to do it. So I'm going with B.
All right. So two things. Number one, if you're a patron, you will receive a screenshot of the question on patreon.com/law. So you can head over there and check it out. And number two, if you would like to play along, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media, on Twitter, on Facebook, on whatever. Include the hashtag TTTBE. Include your guests. Include the reasons therefore. You go along with Thomas. You can try and contradict Thomas. We will pick a winner and announce that winner on next Tuesday's show and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
All right. Incredibly bizarre question. I'm worried about dipping below my 50% eventually. I feel like I haven't been doing that well lately. So hopefully I somehow puzzled that one out, but I don't know. I don't think so. We'll see. All right. Well, that's our show. Thanks so much to everybody for listening and for patronizing. And Lot Awful Movies 19 is out right now. Go get it, patrons. Hope you enjoy it. And that's it for today, and we'll see you on Tuesday.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission. I think I side with Nazi stockbroker here. The racists are right.
Sorry, Brian. I'm totally just with you right now.